imaginations have been stimulated and our hearts have been deeply humbled. The challenge that Marva presented to us was, how do we read our contemporary world through the lens of a biblical theology of creation? For the political and the economic implications of the doctrine of creation are profound, indeed radical in the truest sense of that word. All human beings, as we've been reminded, irrespective of gender, color, achievement, ethnicity, are God's image on the planet Earth. And the Earth, with its resources and its peoples, belong not to governments or to nations or to transnational corporations, but to Yahweh, the Lord. And the Lord of creation provides bountifully for all his creatures, so that scarcity, on which the science of economics rests, is an abnormality, a perversion of the created order. Moreover, the earth commands our respect. It invites our responsible care. To till the earth and to serve it or to keep it go together, in chapter 2, verse 15 of the Genesis story. Human shalom and the shalom of the earth are intertwined. Greed and oppression fracture human solidarity, and the resulting conflicts devastate the earth. And it's in the light of the Creator's promise to the descendants of Noah that never again will he destroy the earth that we see the arrogance, the hubris, and the demonic folly that lie behind the development of weapons of mass destruction and the mythology of nuclear deterrence. The mythology that believes that we human beings can create a perpetual peace on earth this side of the eschaton, and we do this by threatening the destruction of the earth and whole civilizations. What does it mean for us to celebrate the good news of the natural world, the goodness of the natural world, and God's love for his creation, when many around us are gripped by apocalyptic images of nuclear, chemical, and biological war? When the only certainty appears to be that the earth, as well as humanity, has no future? When God himself respects the otherness of what he has made and delights in its creative diversity, we seem hell-bent on turning all animals and plants into mere consumer commodities, biomachines redesigned and shaped by genetic manipulation for the commercial profit of a few. And when forests and seeds and the food chain and the very basis and processes of life, even the human genome, become saleable commodities, then we know that we are culturally worshipping another god. Mammon has taken over from Yahweh. When rich nations consign the notion of sustainable development to the scrap heap, the biosphere is polluted, the land withers, and it's the poor who suffer the brunt of the fallout. The eat, drink, for tomorrow we die mentality of a people terrified to face reality is simply the other side of the frenetic search for absolute security. Last month, the oil tanker, the Prestige, broke up and perished off the coast of Spain. Thousands of tons of crude oil washed ashore, destroying not only marine life, but the livelihoods of vulnerable fishing communities along the Spanish coast. The Prestige was registered in the Bahamas. It was the only ship owned by a Liberian shipping company, and the company is believed to be fronting for one of Greece's largest shipping families. The Prestige carried oil for Crown Resources AG, a company formed in Gibraltar, with offices in London and headquarters in Switzerland. Crown is owned by the Alpha Group, a consortium, one of Russia's largest privately owned financial conglomerates. Alpha is run by Mikhail Friedman, who made his fortune on the proceeds of Soviet state privatizations. According to Fortune magazine, Friedman is worth $2.1 billion. Was this complex web of offshore ownership and registration designed intentionally to prevent the real owners of the Prestige and its cargo from footing the bill for such environmental damage? If so, it shows the ugly face of the globalization of corporate financial activity, an evasion of moral responsibility, a denial of economic stewardship. Let me quote you some words from Joseph Stiglitz, who won the Nobel Prize for Economics last year. In a recent article in the New York Review of Books, he writes, and I quote, "The world of international finance and economics is astonishing. What would seem to be basic and even obvious principles often seem contradicted. One might have thought that money would flow from rich countries to the poor countries, but year after year, exactly the opposite occurs. One might have thought that the rich countries, being far more capable of bearing the risks of volatility in interest rates and exchange rates, would largely bear those risks when they lend money to the poor nations. Yet the poor are left to bear the burdens. Of course, no one expected that the world market economy would be fair, but at least we are taught that it was efficient. Yet these and other tendencies suggest that it is neither." Unquote. So, for example, while the United States and Europe preach free markets and free trade to the poor nations of the world, they themselves continue to subsidize their agribusinesses to the tune of a staggering $350 billion a year, which is six times what they give as global aid. And this allows their agricultural surpluses to flood cheaply into poor countries, depress world prices, and undermine local farming. In addition, tariffs and quotas block the imports of raw materials and manufactured goods from the poor nations to the rich. As one British journalist wrote recently, "The West talks about free trade, but its approach can be summed up in four words. You liberalize, we subsidize." If you want more examples, I'd recommend that you attend the Global Development Bag Lunch on Wednesday afternoon. But dismay, indeed anger, is felt also within the US by some of its more globally minded citizens. Jeffrey Sachs, another eminent economist who is now the director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University, recently wrote an article in The Economist magazine which was entitled "Weapons of Mass Salvation." And let me quote. He says, "While the Bush administration is prepared to spend $100 billion to rid Iraq of weapons of mass destruction, it has been unwilling to spend more than 0.2% of that sum on the UN Global Fund to fight AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. One of the reasons the Bush administration is losing the battle for the world's hearts and minds is precisely that it fights only the war on terror while turning a cold and steely eye away from the millions dying of hunger and disease." And Sachs continues, "White House and State Department foreign policy experts are overwhelmingly directed towards military and diplomatic issues, not development issues. Senior development specialists in the Treasury can be counted on one hand." Commerce between nations needs a framework of just rules. And in democratic societies, the rulemakers must be accountable to the people. The World Trade Organization has the power to decide whether or not we should buy or ban beef boosted by hormones, genetically engineered food, wood from endangered forests, goods made under conditions of near slavery, and so on. For all its weaknesses, the World Trade Organization offers a better hope for the developing world than a system in which bilateral deals are struck between the strong and the weak. In theory, every country has one vote, but in practice, there are secret deals that rich nations make with each other to protect their own interests. At the WTO summit in Doha in November last year, American and European corporate lobby groups outnumbered organizations from the Third World by 6-1. Also, third world countries often send incompetent bureaucrats to argue their case, whereas the rich nations can send high-priced lawyers. Now, given that the church is the only truly global community in the world, is it too much to expect, say, that a group of lawyers and economists from the worldwide church will offer their services freely to poor nations to secure fair terms of global trade and effective mechanisms that will prevent evasion and bullying by the big powers? Is it utopian to press for accountability and transparency in the international banking system, so that funds stored in Western banks by corrupt third world politicians and army generals can be returned to their nations? Again, corruption can only be tackled globally, not locally. The horrors of September 11th, 2001 reminded us of our global interdependence. We now have a global alliance against terrorism, an alliance that is flawed and deeply hypocritical, but nevertheless an alliance. But it's not enough to be against something, we also need to be for something. And why cannot Christian academics and politicians press for an alliance for global justice and a better global environment? Our interdependence makes it all the more necessary to undertake global collective action, and that must begin with us, the global body of Christ. But for us to think globally rather than in narrowly nationalistic or ethnocentric ways, then we must begin by recovering the biblical doctrine of creation.